Welcome back to the 9 till noon show. Good morning if you've just joined us. Thanks to Emma and Paddy again for a very interesting first hour. Let's start off this hour with a positive one here. It comes in from an emailer. Hi, Greg. Please can you say a big thank you to those who helped us out yesterday when my toddler locked himself in the car. Oh, they're always up to no good. What a nightmare. But Lisa goes on to say thank you to Gardaí, Paul and Noel, the wonderful staff at Little Buncrana, all members of the public that stopped to offer help, and especially to the group of gentlemen that eventually got him out safe and sound. Thank you all again for the kindness you showed. A grateful mum. Fair play to everyone that got involved there. Caller says, ignoring the elephant in the room, Highland Radio is one of the most pro-established media outlets in Ireland. And listen, thank you for that. And I really do appreciate you sending that in, because I get ones that say the other way as well, that that this programme feels anti-establishment, which it's not as such. So I appreciate that, just to give a little bit of balance, because if one thinks one thing and one thinks the other, then hopefully the truth lies somewhere in the middle. No surprise with Michelle O'Neill attending the coronation. Ain't Dú's Pádraig Tobin is spot on. Sinn Féin sold out their Irish Republican credentials when they went to Westminster to beg the British government to introduce abortion into the north, is how they see it. A caller says, I'm a pensioner who got the €200 extra from the government, but imagine my shock to discover my rent had been taken twice this week because I got the €200. When I tried to reclaim it, I'm told to try to reclaim it myself. Has this happened to anyone else? Okay, this is an interesting one. So they got the €200 extra payment from the government, but then rent was taken from them twice. I'm not really quite sure the makeup of that or how that might work, but if anyone else out there has an insight or it affected them, please get in touch and see if it's something that we can chase up on listeners' behalf. Today is Go Purple Day, and Maria's first engagement of the day is at... Oh, I'm reading the introduction to our next guest. Right, I'll get to that. But anyway, a good opportunity to mention Go Purple Day. What is the panel's view on protesting outside politicians' homes? Is it a step too far, especially with a new baby in the house? That sounds to me like the person who texted in believes it is. I don't. I think decisions are made not in people's homes, but then people might say decisions are made in the doll that affects people in their homes. That being said, there has to be a better way, doesn't there? Or does there? I just. It's not something that would rest very easy with me. I just think if that's what we're resulting to, then all hope is lost of doing it through any other means. What do you think yourself? Someone asked this question of the panel. Might as well ask you guys out there. Joe Biden has announced that he'll run for the president again in 2024. They ask, does there come a time when you should gracefully retire? But he's in his 80s and he's decided to run again. I think he'll be 86 when his term concludes, the next term, if he's successful in it. Why not? If he's capable, I don't think his age should be a barrier. I'm not talking to his capabilities or not, because it seems an awful lot of people in American politics in the higher echelons of it are older. But if he's competent, age shouldn't be a factor. If he's incompetent, age shouldn't be a factor. So I don't think, personally for me, and as I say, throwing it out to you, the audience, it doesn't matter to me what age somebody is if they're competent. And if they're incompetent, it also doesn't. I don't see the relevance of age in that regard, if that makes sense. I think the focus shouldn't be on whether he's what age he is. It's whether he's competent, regardless of what age he is. My view on Michelle O'Neill is if they don't want to attend the British Parliament, she should decline the invite to the coronation. Okay. I want to get through some of these comments because you're so good to get involved in the conversation. Dr. Joe Kelly was 100% right yesterday. People are too distracted with trying to live, survive our daily lives that they pay no attention to politics. Big loss for the Irish people. We need another Kennedy or Collins to get the people involved again. But I think I don't think it is actually that. I think there's definitely part of that. I think what is though is that there are some people that feel so detached that politics doesn't speak to them. It won't improve their situation, or maybe won't even disimprove it. So they feel, what's the point in getting involved? And then what happens in maybe coming close to election time, you start all of a sudden looking after those that might be more inclined to vote. And that's perhaps what we might see over the next year or so, that some budgets will be targeted towards the demographics that generally do vote. Maybe the squeezed middle, maybe the working poor. The big focus will be in that direction because they're probably more likely to get out and vote. That's maybe a cynical attitude, but I do think there are large portions of the population that feel really that whatever happens, it's not going to affect them, maybe even positively or negatively. Greg, the government is handling it the way they are. It's arrogance. Doesn't matter where the information came from. It's true, and it's looking very likely that it's true. Well, the basic fundamental reporting of the ditch has been confirmed by Niall Collins' statement. It just comes down to the nitty-gritties of it now. A caller says if the ditch was attacking a certain opposition party, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael would be lapping it up, in my opinion. Well, if the shoe was on the other foot, okay. Robert Watt and Collins' arrogance certainly shines a light on questionable politics for when it suits them and not held to account. And more coming in. But what we will do is take a break for the bingo numbers, because I know you're waiting to play, and then our next guest will join us. Okay, you're very welcome back to the programme. Welcome into studio now, MEP, Fine Gael MEP for this region, Maria Walsh. Thanks so much for joining us. Good to have you with us.
I'm glad to be back into the county again.
Yeah, exactly. I normally don't comment on people's appearances because I don't want to get cancelled or something. You know, I don't know. But I couldn't help but notice you're dressed in purple, and it is Go Purple Day by accident or design. I'm hoping it's the latter.
No, it's a little bit more pinkish than purplish, but I'm delighted because this is the brightest color.
Is this purple?
I would call the sound piece there purple. Okay. Yeah, so I blend. But it was the brightest thing I had, and considering today is such an important day, I was trying to make sure I was doing my bit in terms of not just talking about awareness, but also looking a little bit more colourful and in line with such such an important day.
Yeah, it is. It's a very important day, and it's being marked around the county with various coffee mornings. On Garda Síochána have one going on in Letterkenny as well. The Donegal Domestic Violence Services. I think it serves as a good opportunity to talk about these issues that aren't going away, and in fact, For a lot of women, for different reasons, things are going backwards around the world.
Yeah, unfortunately, and we often, when we look at issues like domestic violence or financial psychological violence, coercive control, which is inclusive of abuse online too, just for any listeners. You know, I was really fortunate to speak with Marie Hainsworth right before this, the manager of Donegal Domestic Violence Service. And here on the ground here in Donegal, over 300 women have experienced domestic violence. And that is just the reports of women who are coming forward. Sadly, we know from even EU research and with Women's Aid that number is more than likely on the low side, and we need to get serious about this. And it's we've talked multiple times before about mental health and the lack of inequalities or social discourse, and unfortunately women or young children are always the most impacted by that. But when you look from our entire history, from survivors and victims in Magdalen Laundries to where we are now, sadly, there is a huge deficit, and this is simply not good enough in 2023 to have 41% of Irish women know someone within their circle, immediate circle, who've experienced domestic violence or a violence of form. It's staggering.
And that is, and I think we can say that's not actually going to be reflective of the instances of it. And I think even things like the in Britain, them testing alert signals, that one of the conversations that had to be had, that if you have a second phone for counselling or for whatever it might be, if you are the victim of domestic violence, to make sure it's on airplane mode or powered off. You know, that's the reality, that something is just testing this alarm system is something that a lot of people have to be conscious of, that it might not alert an abusive partner. I mean, it's really sad, isn't it?
Yeah, it's heartbreaking that someone has to be that calculated to live and live somewhat safely in a world that is more than likely being calculated for them by their abuser. And I just want to acknowledge, again, Marie and I had a really great conversation. One thing in line with what you just shared there was people, perpetrators, using the Hague Convention now that Northern Ireland in the UK is effectively a third country. And that was the first time I'd heard that. I had visited Longford Women's Service. I'd went to Esker House in Athlone. So in every trip I do around the constituency, I always make sure I meet with groups such as Donegal Domestic Violence. And that was the first time I had heard, but naturally you would hear something like that given we're on a border. I just didn't realise it was that to the extent of, you know, perpetrators using their children and legislation at an EU level to and an international level to essentially abuse a woman. And that is down to the point where you say where, as you shared, where phones are going on airplane mode. That is the extent of which the tools, the arsenal that victims are experiencing and survivors. I want to say the language is really important on this one, victims and survivors.
Yeah, for sure. I understand exactly what you're saying. You recently met with the North and Western Regional Assembly. Obviously, I presume you used it as an opportunity to touch base with Fine Gael reps in this region and to hear what the issues for them were. What was your takeaway from that? Maybe firstly, because it might give us an insight, with your meeting with councillors.
Yeah, it was a really important meeting, and a lot of the Northwest Regional Assembly, obviously, they work the framework that the EU is, and for those listeners, is they're working with businesses, community groups, making sure whatever funding is available that fits the region is being applied for, and then putting pressure on public reps like myself to make sure that we're doing our job and what we agree to when we got elected. And it was very fascinating to me. You know, I proposed a couple of the priorities that I was working on. Of course, mental health being a core of that, mental health services, and hearing from not just Fine Gael, but right across the Northwest Regional Assembly, eight counties, where I think every councillor that spoke both publicly and privately with me had shared the pressures that their constituents are experiencing and the need for a more collected approach. We heard other things like community policing and the fact that constituents have come forward saying they need somewhere or they need to see people more on the streets. I heard that. Addiction services in terms of the rise of drug use was not just felt by one county, but every county that was represented. And then you went in to business supports in terms of labour shortages. And as I mentioned, I'd propose some of my priorities, one being, which a lot of people don't always think at an EU level, it impacts the constituency of Midlands Northwest, but the revision of an anti-trafficking directive is about to take place. And I'm one of the co-writers of that revision. And unfortunately, right now in Ireland, linked to Go Purple Day, sadly, is the fact that we have about 1,000 people, predominantly women and children, that are being trafficked in and out of Ireland on a yearly basis. Again, similar to domestic violence, those numbers are often on the low because of reporting and judicial. Sadly, society online and offline is moving a hell of a lot faster than our judicial services and the supports on Garda Síochána need. So with that, a lot of the councillors had flagged just what do they need to do? How can they show up better? How can they make sure if they are seeing something that they have the skills and training to point people where they need to go? So it was a combination of economic and social policy. So it was really, really important that we're not just looking at EU for a funding stream, but also to build our social contract too.
Yeah. And I think you talk often, we've talked in the past about people's mental health. And a lot of it is going to be driven by issues, you know what I mean, in terms of access to services, which could help people earlier on, the stress and strains of issues like defective concrete and others, issues in terms of access to GPs and healthcare. So I'm saying it's not the root cause of it all, but often we talk about, well, what can we do to help people with mental health issues in terms of getting them through that? But I think also we need to start focusing on what can we do to help prevent that or to help mitigate that in advance. And I'm sort of, Maria, getting a little bit, I find myself getting a little bit frustrated in that, you know, we have Europe. We have European money. We have all the local representatives and what have you. Then we have a massive surplus here in this country. And yet we have people like Donegal Domestic Violence Services that's struggling for resources, that's struggling to find accommodation for women when they make that call that we encourage them to do so. So when are we going to stop talking about it, right, and start actually saying, let's deliver, because we're a small country, right, and nothing should be beyond us here. We have the money, notwithstanding our massive debt, but I don't think that's, I don't think anyone's going to sort that out anyway, right? It's 240-odd million, whatever. So when are we actually going to start, when is the government going to start, or the agencies of it, and actually start addressing these problems? We know them, we have the resources to fix it, we just need the will. And that lack of will is really damaging politics in this country and others as well.
Well, I mean, sadly, this is where myself comes forward here, probably less of a political hash and more of a community lens to say, I understand that. You know, listening and speaking with Marie this morning as she walked through what the services are doing, what they want to do more of, what their demand and the fact that that's growing, and the fact that, you know, when they reach out to mental health services, be it TUSLA or HSE, when they reach out to those working in the housing system, social workers as a whole, talk therapists, that there's just simply not enough. Within all of that, I do want to say that there is a will, and I don't know if I'm going to convey this correctly, but, you know, I can say on behalf of my political party in particular, there is a will to support people who are going through incredibly challenging times. And I can appreciate that we're just not moving fast enough, but the speed of that is changing. And, you know, that's the reason why I got up to get involved in politics, because it wasn't moving at the scent. Now I can turn out and say, you know, X, Y, and Z is being delivered. 1, 2, 3 is being delivered. And yes, there is deliverance and happening, but not at the pace of which the crisis is.
I could sit opposite you here now, and you'd be well able, I'm sure, to take me on, but to try and paint you into a corner or something about, I'm not interested in that. And people sometimes, I think, misunderstand what I try and do sometimes, in that I'm not anti-government.
No.
Or some people do. Some people don't speak to me anymore because they think I am,
well, that's
right?
That's disappointing. I'm not saying this because you're opposite me. I mean, I think we need free media who are pro-democratic.
100%. Yeah. But my point is that it's just, if good things happen, let's shout through the rooftops as well. If we can get more housing, if we can get more resources, you know what I mean? Like, I will scream that from the rooftops equally. But unfortunately, in a show like this, where you try and give people's concerns a platform, it's going to sound bad towards the decision makers. Mm-hmm. But you hope that they do make the right decisions down the line before it's too late. Because we had an interesting conversation between 9 and 10 where we were talking about people voting and what would be voting for and why would they vote, because it doesn't feel like it actually achieves or does anything. But I don't want this show to turn into that either, right? But when are we going to start feeling the changes then? When are we going to start sort of, because at the moment we have nurses that are leaving because they're not getting paid enough and they're not looked after, teachers that are leaving because they're not paid, mass emigration, guards leaving in their droves, right? They can't get a decent pay rise, they can't buy a house, but you know yourself, politicians just got a 5% pay rise, okay? That's the kind of stuff that needs to be addressed. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Because it's so obvious, Marie. People can't see past it, Marie. I beg your pardon.
I don't want to talk myself up and saying that I'm not also hearing that when I visit the likes of Esker House in Athlone, and they're waiting 2+ years to get planning permission to even begin to build a safe refuge for those experiencing domestic violence. When you speak to councillors like I did last Friday in Roscommon at the Northwest Regional Assembly, and you're hearing the impact drugs is having and addiction services are having and the lack of that support, and just know those listening that, you know, I can comfortably speak on behalf of myself and my party to say you don't get in politics to sit back and let these issues develop and grow. There is impact, to your point. We're not moving at the pace we need to. There is stuff changing and moving in terms of access to more third level courses. So when we're looking at social workers or talk therapists, there's an easier access for people to look at those careers.
It just takes a while for them to come through.
Yeah,
as well,
and then, but then looking at the retention policies too. I mean, we need to pay people an adequate wage so that they can live in a country that is on paper and in reality developed. And we're certainly not. We certainly need to be doing more of that.
Yeah,
because ultimately, to your point, and why we're here today, it's often disproportionately impacting women and children when we don't get this right.
I also think sometimes, and it's probably not the case because there might be an abundance of these professionals in other country, but whilst we have people that emigrate from here to do work elsewhere in richer countries, we are drawing resources from often poorer countries. And I hope aren't leaving a gap behind doing so.
Look to the point of, I spoke to the Polish ambassador designated to Ireland quite recently because about 120,000 Polish communities call Ireland their home. And that was derived from, sadly, the financial crisis. But we have benefited and felt that impact of that Polish community and multiple other communities that are building the country. And I think I must say, you ask what we're doing and what can be done in terms of budget spend. This is where I feel the EU can and has stepped in. So like I mentioned, the Domestic Violence Day, which we're acknowledging today, the impact that has on funding for women's aid to do more research. We need to know the data in order to fully fund and not have this conversation in a year's time to say more women has experienced domestic violence than they did previously.
Make sure the money's going in the right places. As well, of course.
Absolutely.
Just to mention, Lifeline Inishowen, another amazing organisation which we often mention on the show and support fully. They do amazing work and some amazing people working behind the scenes there as well. Lifeline Inishowen are hosting a coffee morning in Wesley Hall, Carndonna for Go Purple Day with An Garda Síochána Bunkrana. That starts at 2 p.m. So well done to everyone involved in that. Akola says, I think domestic violence education should be taught in primary schools. Children need to be learned, taught from a very early age that violence in the home is not normal, and but sometimes that's complicated too, because sometimes those children are being raised in homes.
To the text that just come in around language, I think one of the, and again speaking with Marie at Donegal Domestic Violence Services and multiple others, ask the question. If you see something, report to the guards. Call it out in a safe space space. And then we're always on this lifelong journey. You're never going to have all the information at their fingertips for the conversation that needs to happen, but ignoring it is not going to keep anybody safer. So we need to make sure that this awareness is growing, and not just on days like today where it goes purple, but every day.
Right. Last couple of minutes, I think you recognise, or we all recognise, or we'd love to see a bit of positive discrimination here in the Northwest, right? We want a railway. Yeah. We want better roads, whatever, you know, is required, more investment. How do we achieve that? Are there avenues in Europe that we could be pursuing to try and, a lot has happened actually. You know, let's talk about some of the positives now. I think, you know, connections to the capital have improved.
Yes.
From South Donegal anyway, and I'm going to be selfish because that's where I live, right?
Yeah.
Broadband. Now, we are seeing a lot of broadband in rural areas, a lot of people able to get it. You know what I mean? We're not there yet, but things are improving. So there are areas in the Northwest.
Billions spent in terms of digitization.
That is working, right? So recognising that, okay.
Yeah.
But do you feel that there are funding avenues or
Absolutely.
Stuff that we could be pursuing to improve things?
Yeah, the benefit of us and our relationship with the European Union is twofold in my eyes. One, direct funding, and a lot what the Northwest Regional Assembly do and the councillors right across the political spectrum too, are working together. And I think that better connectivity of, you know, what one country in the EU is doing really, really well, how can we partner with them and then co-fund? I think what would be very successful when we look at education and trying to build up our rural communities is the fact that Minister Simon Harris, what I would hope and what I'm putting pressure on, would appoint ATU to be the holder of the new veterinary school. I think that would create a huge impact us here across the region. I don't think rail is at the point where it should be. So when we look at there, of course, with Donegal Airport. When we look at some bus services, of course, that's positive. But I think rail is really, really important. When you look at the fact that other EU areas and regions are far ahead of us on that. So I think there's definitely funding, and I know there's definitely funding streams in there. And then diversification. And what that it means is communities growing and scaling, welcoming new communities in. What other business models can we get into? And I say that from a farming background, a fishery background. You know, what other areas? This agritourism, we have the Wild Atlantic Way. There's so much positivity that this region has to offer. And it's a case of getting that message out and being very, very structured and working together on funding streams.
What do you think?
There is money there.
Sorry, go ahead. Yeah, okay.
No, I'd say there is money there. Yeah. And it shouldn't just be national governments applying. This is where we need to lift the red tape for community groups also to work together across the region and apply for that EU funding too.
All right, or even Derry and Donegal in that city sort of status. Yeah, okay, get you.
You see it with the Three Sisters down in South East. You know, there's no reason why we can't do that across this region working with over the border counties.
What do you think of talk of potentially two rural Ireland parties representing Ireland? I think it plays into Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil's hands, to be honest with you, because I think it splits because I think he's got very loyal following. Lots of people listening to us they might have their frustrations, right? But they'll still back you when the time comes. I think really the more parties there are, and I'm not in any way saying it shouldn't happen, I think it actually doesn't have the effect maybe they want it to have. It's like running single issue candidates on issues that the opposition are saying that they are in favour of. You can see the complication. But what do you think of?
Yeah, well, I can say this from my own experience. You know, there was when I first started looking to get involved in politics. Absolutely, you could have joined any political party or ran as an independent. But actually, for me, it came down to the fundamental change will happen at a decision making table, which in my eyes was Fine Gael. And if you're at the table, then your voice is getting heard and you're able to speak with decision makers at a speedier pace and making sure that direct communications happen from your constituency to the cabinet table. So for me, democracy looks very different on very different people. And if there is multiple parties developing, then that is the wish of the people. I would just hope that we as a Fine Gael party, and I'm running an event with Fine Gael here on the 19th of May in Letterkenny that is opening up and trying to encourage more women and other groups to ask questions in a really safe space about what the party's doing, what we could be doing more of, and trying to break that barrier that we are a party of people who want to represent communities and deal with issues all that we've discussed this morning. So like I say, democracy looks different on many different people. I wish them well, but I would hope that we as a party continue to attract and open the door for people who are looking to...
Do you like the direction of your party at the moment? Are you any frustrations? Because, you know, you'll have heard some of the comments from your party leader on different issues. Mm-hmm. I think yesterday we had Micheál Martin sort of dragging Russia into, I don't know if you're familiar with that story, maybe you were travelling there on the ditch suggesting sort of, you know, well, Russia this and Russia that. And do you like the way, I asked you this question before actually, I did. Do you like the way national politics, do you like the direction of your party in a political way? Because you speak, right, exactly how I think everyone would like every party to be, but are you actually seeing that in reality?
Yeah, well, I mean, listen, do I want to be speaking to you about mental health services or the lack of them this time next year?
Not.
Absolutely not.
No.
I fundamentally believe we have a party leader in Leo Varadkar and many other senior cabinet members like Helen McEntee, who's doing phenomenal work in the Justice Department and has done so since her tenure started. Do I feel social contract and social policy? And what I mean by that for listeners, it's mental health services, it's equality for not some, but all. It's if you want to live in Donegal in a safe house, in a safe community, then you are deserving of that. Do I want to see more of those issues picked up and actually moved? Absolutely. But for me, this party will do that, and we just need to keep the pressure on. So that for me is really, really important, right, that we continue that drive. But there's always homework to do, and there's always stuff that needs to get done. And I wouldn't take from that. I'm not here to say we're not doing enough. I think we could be doing a hell of a lot more, but we're certainly moving in the right direction that I like us to be in.
All right, Maria Walsh, Fine Gael MEP for Midlands North West. Thanks for calling in. Appreciate it. And giving us an opportunity actually to talk more about Go Purple Day, which I think was a great function of the piece as well. Have a lovely day. Back with more after the break. Brian McDade joins us on the program now. Brian, thanks so much for taking the call today.
You're very welcome. Thank you for talking to me.
No, it's good to have you on the program. You and your family were living in Sudan, and obviously, because of events over there, you were able to get out and home. Before we get into that, what were you doing in Sudan? What was life like for you there, Brian? How long have you been there?
I've been there since 2007. And yeah, I mean, for a number of years, life was relatively normal. I mean, it's a culture shock. It's a completely different continent. And, you know, many of the conveniences that you're used to aren't there, or certainly very different form. So you adjust. But yeah, I mean, we were bobbing along nicely for a number of years. And then there were a few events that I suppose that started changing that. And obviously, most recently, what has happened has just, completely turned our worlds upside down.
What was life in Khartoum like up until recently? Does it feel like a safe area? Is it rural? Is it urban? Brian, what is it like?
Well, we were in Khartoum, and, you know, it's a big African capital city. It's quite spread out, low rise. I worked in an international school. I was a primary school teacher, still am, until the end of the year, in an international school. And it was at one point, you know, a thriving international community. Things did start changing. The last 5 years, for example, have been a little bit topsy-turvy. There was long-standing dictator. He was ousted in revolution in 2019. And since then, there's been a kind of uneasy peace of a sort. There was an uneasy alliance between military and civilian and an interim government. And then there was a coup. And at that point, I mean, obviously, the military took charge, where the two warring, the leaders of the warring parties right now, Hemeti and Burhan, they were working in, yeah, like I say, a fairly an uneasy partnership. Yeah. And various issues led to tensions between them. There was still plenty of cautious optimism that they could reach some kind of agreement. And it was all about, it centered on the rapid support forces and how they would be absorbed into the Sudan Armed Forces, the regular army. And I guess the pathway to civilian rule, it's always been a problematic in terms of the mechanics of it and how exactly that would unfold.
So yeah,
that's where a lot of the tension has come from.
The complexities of that's going to perhaps leave it a very long time before there is some sort of a stability, but we might get to that. When did things get to the point where you were like, right, okay, I'm aware of what's going on, but I feel somewhat safe? When did things start to get to the point where you were thinking, we might have to make a move here?
It all happened very quickly. I mean, 15th of April, I got a message through during the days of the revolution. And then after that, we created a WhatsApp group from our school just to advise each other of any potential trouble or hazards or risks that might occur during the day, be it demonstrations that, you know, that might be, handled somewhat robustly, so to speak. Anything that might have disrupted our day. And I got a message through on that WhatsApp group telling me to stay at home, which is quite a direct message they received, a direct order and quite alarming. And then another one that basically said, things are unstable. And then shortly thereafter, we started hearing some shelling, and then it just intensified after that. We moved to our basement, lucky to have a basement, mm-hmm. quite frankly, and stayed there for the duration of the week. And then a ceasefire, you know, after ceasefire being announced and repeatedly broken during the week, we felt, okay, well, this is no one, neither of these sides is willing to give an inch here. And based with, and also backed up by the strong language that was being used by both of them, that neither of them would capitulate. They're speaking in very strong terms, war rhetoric, obviously. And then we got to the stage where we thought this could very quickly we could get sucked into this. We're not in the epicenter per se, but we're very, very close to some of the strategic targets. So, you know, it was getting very dangerous. A number of relatives and people I know have had stray bullets find their way into their homes. And that's how a lot of people were killed, you know.
And Brian, in terms of your safety there, now, obviously, we're at the point now where you couldn't really stay there and protect yourself and your family. But would the danger of being caught up in it or maybe being targeted? I don't know how either side or both sides might see people from Ireland or England or wherever they might be in the wider scale of things. So would it be a case of getting caught up in the crossfire, metaphorically speaking, or might you be seen as a target by either of the parties?
Possibly a bit of both, actually. Initially, the greater risk is being caught while there's fighting actively continuing, and that obviously manifests itself in many ways. But while there are gun battles, you know, exchanges of gunfire, it is very likely that you could get caught in a crossfire. And like I said, stray bullets is how, you know, a lot of people have lost their lives. In terms of being targeted or certainly, being targeted as a foreigner, quite possibly. I mean, I think there's generally, there was frustration. There was an agency, UN agency, that was, I'm not sure created, but certainly brought in to oversee a transition to democracy there. But that was seen by a lot of the old sort of hardliners as foreign meddling. Mm. So, you know, that can very easily grow to a point where you do find yourself a target or certainly not feeling particularly welcome. So I was very self-conscious of that as well. Mm. But for me, first and foremost, it was the need to get out was basically driven by the growing danger of being there.
Yeah, for sure. Anyone in the same position would do the same thing. So in terms of then how you get out, because I presume even with some external contact, you are isolated in a city, in a basement, and you have to figure out, well, how do I get us all to safety? So what was the plan and then how did you end up getting out?
How it happened, we registered, I mean, as EU, Irish passport holders, Irish citizens, we were advised to register with the Irish Embassy in Nairobi. We don't have...
Hello, can you hear me, Brian?
Yes, sorry, I thought I lost you for a second.
No.
We don't have an embassy... Don't have an embassy in Khartoum, so the closest is Kenya, and they obviously take care of citizens in neighboring countries. So we registered with them, and then we were in regular contact with them. And right up until Saturday evening, the advice was to stay at home. There was no evacuation plan as such. But then on Sunday morning, everything changed very, very quickly. And I got word that the evacuation plans were in place. Mm-hmm. We got information through. Someone contacted me to say that I should go to the Spanish ambassador, who very, very handily enough is a neighbor of mine. So I was able to go there quickly. And then quickly thereafter, information coming, okay, as an Irish citizen, you can go to the French embassy. And in actual fact, every day I've been getting updates through consular services from Nairobi advising me of other evacuations that are taking place and obviously my eligibility as an EU citizen. What has changed is whenever we made the move, we didn't have to drive to the airfield. You know, the evacuations are being, the planes are taken off from an airfield. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the civilian airport is completely inaccessible and I don't know what sort of damage has been done there. So it's taken place from an airfield north of Khartoum. We went in convoy, and now things have changed. People are being asked to make their own way there. And that itself is quite a perilous journey, quite frankly. It was tense, and I can't imagine doing that in my own vehicle.
Yeah, finally, Brian, we're delighted you're home. Of course, much of the focus has been, and probably will continue to be, getting the likes of yourselves and others out But we've spoken to Sudanese people in the past who are concerned about the direction of the country, and I suppose there's going to be an awful lot of people left behind already, you know, in poverty and hunger and what have you. And I suspect it'll fall off the news cycle once, you know, the Westerners are out. How does that make you feel? Because I presume there's a connection there. There's an affinity now with Sudan. I don't want to put words or emotions into you, but I suspect there is. But it'll slip off the news agenda, and what the regular people are left there with, it's incredibly sad.
It's heartbreaking, and I think it is worth pointing out, you know, just to add to what you've said. We do have connections there, you know, and I'm reading at stories where family members, you know, particularly the doctors, there's a very strong medical, you know, connection within the medicine community. There are a lot of Sudanese doctors here who went to celebrate Eid, got caught up in it, and they're able to come because they're Irish citizens, but their families aren't. So it puts them in an awful position and a dreadful choice. Who wants to ever make a choice like that? So, you know, you have those heartbreaking family stories, but then, like you said, whenever people are evacuated and not everyone is as fortunate to be able to flee, you know, you have small business owners, your rickshaw drivers, your taxi drivers, they don't have the choices. They don't have that option. So it's heartbreaking. And I just hope that it does stay relevant because it is current. And it doesn't become very quickly become old news and forgotten. But it needs to be relevant because it is an unfolding humanitarian crisis, if nothing else. And certainly more so than even when the fighting stops. You know, there's still going to be the aftermath, which is picking up the pieces, and normal people, regular people, will have to do that as they usually do.
Yeah, and finally, in the last 30 seconds or a minute, Brian, I mean, as I say, this is going to take a long time to resolve. We hope it wasn't the case. You've been there a long time now, and now you've had to pivot back here. Have you been able to process all of that yet? Because this is an unforced, huge change in you and your family's life.
It's massive. I mean, we had to pack up. I had to pack up 16 years of life in a backpack. So, you know, I know those material considerations, all the property and that you accumulate over a certain amount of time. But I haven't had time to process it now. And I think, you know, I just need to sit and stare at a wall for a couple of days and think about the kind of realities that have changed dramatically. And I don't know what we can do to recover. It's going to take a while, and there's going to be a lot of things, a lot of considerations that have to be made. And I mean, my wife is Sudanese Irish. Her father studied in Trinity many, many years ago. That's his initial connection with Ireland. And obviously there's been that connection ever since, and significant connections there. So it's a much bigger picture than just myself and my immediate family.
All right.
And there's a lot to think about, so it's going to take time.
Well, Brian, thanks for giving us an insight and an understanding, and I appreciate it. And best wishes to you and your family, and thinking on those that you're thinking on having not left behind, but they remain there. Brian, thanks for your time.
Thank you for having me on.
Bye-bye. Brian McDade there.